How do the best data scientists in the world master their data sets, train their models, and climb the data science ladder? Let's ask them. My name's Jeremy, and this is the Towards Data Science podcast.
Institution you're coming from, you can get access to the very latest research.
We also have to make sure that we're constantly revisiting our foundations and justifying why we're using the methods we are.
At that time, I said, and I want people to hear this, that you have worth and you have skills, and there's someone who needs that somewhere.
Hello and welcome to episode number 11 of the Towards Data Science podcast, your home for the best in-depth conversations about data science in the entire universe. My name is Jeremy. I'm part, as always, of the team over at the Sharpest Minds Data Science Mentorship Program, and I'm here with Ed, who's also joining us for today's episode.
Hi, guys.
Now, today's episode is a bit of a change of pace. One of the things we realized looking back on the first 10 episodes of the podcast is that we never really took a deep dive into data science at enterprise-scale companies. By enterprise scale, by the way, I really just mean big juggernaut companies that have been around since, let's say, before the 2000s or so. And I actually, we were talking about this, I actually think this was a bit of an oversight, because enterprise scale data science really is its own beast, and because so many people work in these companies or aspire to work in these companies, I think it's really worth taking some time to talk about them. Enterprise scale data science comes with unique challenges, both technical and cultural challenges, that aren't necessarily obvious if you're used to thinking of startups or even more established tech companies like Apple or Google and so on. So we really wanted to do this right. And I think today's guest is just right for that goal. Sanjeev Sharma is a vice president and global practice director of data modernization and strategy at Delphix, which is a big company that helps other big companies take care of their data and make sure that they're using good data strategy. And before that, he actually worked for quite a long time at IBM, where he had a bunch of senior roles, all oriented around data strategy, things like cloud infrastructure, basically every one of the things that makes a big company's data clock tick. Sanjeev's really seen the whole evolution of enterprise data science strategy from way before the term data science even existed. And he's worked with some of the biggest companies in the business. So we're really happy to have him here today. Sanjeev, thanks so much for joining us for the podcast.
Glad to be here.
Well, we're very glad to have you. Now, you led data engineering and infrastructure efforts at IBM until relatively recently. Then you joined Delphix as a VP, where now your focus has been more on the data modernization and data strategy side of things. What I find really cool here is you have experience on the really practical side of data science, getting things into production, really making the rubber meet the road. And I definitely want to make sure we touch on all that during this conversation. But probably a good place to start would be to just get an idea for how you first got started in the space, especially given that it would have been in a period when the hype around data tooling and data science was nowhere near where it is today. How did you get your start in data science?
Sure. Thanks, Jeremy. And, you know, I joined Delphix just under a year ago. So, you know, a year ago, and before that, I was at IBM. And at IBM, I held multiple roles, like it is typical for a large company like that. And the last role I had, which was just under for a year and a half, was a part of IBM's Cloud Architecture Guild, which was responsible for setting all architect workloads IBM's clients were deploying to various cloud platforms, not just IBM's cloud, but also other public clouds and also private clouds. And around that time was when we were seeing, as you mentioned, Jeremy, the hype around data science, right, beginning to peak. Mm-hmm. And more of the customers, the large enterprises I was working with, were coming to myself and my colleagues and asking about the infrastructure requirements and the deployment automation requirements and the data management capabilities that they would need to get serious about data science. You know, you could see that these large enterprises were beginning to invest in AI and machine learning, but their data science efforts were fairly experimental at that time, right? They were trying to, you know, build chatbots or do some kind of basic inference development, basic model development. And that was, you know, my exposure to start off with. And that became, you know, started my journey down this path.
IBM, I guess, is known for being one of the kind of mega companies that kind of started off the data science and machine learning ball rolling in 2010 with all the stuff like Watson and stuff like that. So it sounds like you were in a bit of a, almost like a consulting role, like helping other companies get to that same point. Is that more or less what it was like?
Absolutely. I mean, that was my role. I was a client-facing, solution architect by role definition. I was, in a role where I would examine customers' requirements, seek to understand them, spend time with them, and, you know, figure out what their business and technical goals, and then work towards crafting a solution which that client would need. Both in terms of and primarily focusing on the infrastructure needs, which was that was the focus of my goals. So whether they were trying to build a data lake or needed several test beds in order to test their do testing and training of their various models, and needed to wrangle, for lack of a better term, large data sets. You know, those were the kind of scenarios I was helping our client, IBM's clients construct.
I find this really kind of an interesting space, because a lot of the people that we've talked to, even if they were on the, I guess, the big startup side, like we've talked to people at LinkedIn and Airbnb and so on, but there the approach is very different. I mean, these are really companies that started off with a data conscious mindset. They're not sort of enterprise, like old school enterprise companies, for want of a better term. Whereas here you would have interacted implicitly with all these companies that are really just discovering the value of their data from scratch. Presumably the quality of the data really isn't what it needs to be. What were some of the special challenges that you discovered when working with companies like that, that maybe some folks who are looking to do data science, potentially companies like that, might have to be aware of?
Right. And, that's actually a very good question, because there is a distinct difference between, what one sees at a startup or a fairly company which is just beginning to grow or just coming to mainstream and has only a modern technology stack. Mm-hmm. As opposed to a large enterprise, which might have over its 40, 50 year existence. And I was just, last month talking to a company which is more than 140 years old.
Wow.
And all that data is there, some of it might not even be digitized. So the other thing to understand is, because these around for a while have typically gone through several mergers and divestitures and several acquisitions of technologies and multiple technology stacks which evolved over the years, they are not monolithic. They are not homogenous, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I always joke that if I got off at a wrong floor of the elevator, got off the elevator on the wrong floor in some of these companies, I would feel like I'm a different company, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you get off on one floor and people are working on green screens, and you get off at another floor and it's all, the cool, people with everything in the cloud, with a cloud first mentality, with all their data, running in RDS. That's where the challenge is, right? The challenge is trying to make these various technology stacks work together, mm-hmm. trying to make these various data sources become cohesive. And it does present a lot of old data sets where, we're running in, not only running in old database technologies, which are difficult to access and manage, but also have very poor data quality, have very poor data sanitation. Mm-hmm. Because the data has just been sitting there, and they reported on that data, they had that data used to do audits and compliance reporting. And if a particular customer wants their transaction history from 20 years ago, because of whatever reason, they have the ability to get that data from the archives. But beyond that, they've never had to use that data to gain any insights from it. And now the opportunity lies. But when they look at that data, they see the lack of quality.
So not only have these companies been have this long existence, and like they're kind of this mishmash of different suborgs with different technologies, but also they haven't had to use their data for anything like large scale or comprehensive. So there hasn't been a forcing function to actually integrate everything together into one big lake that you can search like completely.
Absolutely. And they have spent a lot of money building the data lakes and doing the data engineering side. But as they've started now, once those are built out and maybe some of the data is in the data lake, they are realizing that a lot of the data is not usable because of data quality issues. Mm. And let's not even go into, and maybe we'll go into it, the the data culture, which is really hurting these companies because they are not designed organizationally and don't have the culture to share data and think of data as an asset which can be cultivated to value. So that the way they treat data and the way they manage data, the way they govern data is very, very old school and not compatible with today's modern application delivery and data science needs.
Actually, I have one question. What was the hardest one? Like, what's one that sticks in your mind? Is like, oh man, that one was really hard to do, but it worked in the end.
Well, the jury is still out whether it worked in the end, but
okay, I guess, yeah.
But I can give you two examples, right? So one in which a customer of I was working with had terabytes and terabytes of data. Almost they were you know, by the time they were done, their data lake would probably be in the petabyte scale.
Oh my God.
And they would run reports and they would find that they were hydrating the data lake with data, which included data from a subsidiary. On paper, they had, you know, cleansed all their databases of their subsidiary beyond what was needed to be kept because they were still their company, you know, till 3 years ago, and they needed it all for reporting and, you know, and to track, you know, historic data. But in their current reports, that data would show up, and it was just a human effort, a manual effort at the end of every quarter, at the end of every annual cycle to go cleanse that data.
Oh my God.
Yep.
So they're still receiving data from a company they'd spun off.
Well, hopefully they weren't receiving data, but that data from 3 years ago was making its way into the data lake, and they had challenges trying to segregate it.
As a question for people who might be less initiated and looking to either break into the field or maybe they're more focused on just the modeling side, and they hear you talk about data lakes as a point of infrastructure, would you mind kind of expanding a little bit on, like, what is a data lake exactly and how does it fit into the typical data science lifecycle at a big org?
Well, a data lake is created for the explicit purpose of addressing those multi-technology stack challenges, which we were talking about, you know, just a couple of minutes ago, right? So if I have multiple databases or data stored away in multiple legacy systems, it is not efficient. It's not even viable in a lot of cases to have my model be trained or be run against in production against all those various data sets, all those various data sources. So a data lake becomes a common repository for me to store all that raw data and have that available for the data scientist to use for whatever purpose. So she could use a subset of it for training the data, for training the model, another subset for testing the model and not running the model against large data sets in the data lake. So the idea is that you would have one place and that data lake would be served up through what is typically known as a data mart, where somebody can have this catalog of data, data sets where they can go and pick and choose what data sets they need for their explicit purpose, depending on where on the life cycle they are, whether they're training, validating, or actually running their model in production. So the data lake is, you know, a very large database, which can store both relational and non-relational data sets for the explicit purpose of use for your data science work.
And this brings up something you were talking about just before we started recording, the importance of data inventories, that sort of thing. Really the kinds of things I think that a lot of people who don't spend their time on data infrastructure don't necessarily think of. And nonetheless, that play such an important role in the life of the data science lifecycle in big companies. You've actually been a big advocate for something you referred to as data ops, which is a lot like DevOps, basically for data. I think this would be a good thing to touch on as well, and just given that you have so much deep expertise in this area, could you expand on the idea, well, actually, maybe first on the idea of DevOps for anyone who's uninitiated, and then you know, how data ops compares?
Sure, and you know, DevOps is an area which I've been working on for you know, since the beginning. I think I did my first ever presentation at a conference in DevOps on DevOps back in 2012 or 2013. So I've been, you know, involved with the industry for a while, written two books on it. I wrote the original DevOps for Dummies and then the more recent DevOps Adoption Playbook. So DevOps is essentially an approach to make the application development and delivery process more lean and efficient, right? So how do I get requirements coming in at one end or change requests coming at for an application coming at one end of my application delivery lifecycle to code running in production being used by my customers at the other end of the lifecycle. How do I make that more lean and efficient and get feedback from the customers and the end users who are using my system or application to continuously improve the infrastructure on which I'm delivering so I'm able to deliver the quality of service my users expect. And also I'm continuously improving the process by which I'm delivering so that all the stakeholders and all the processes those stakeholders are working on to convert those requirements to first design an architecture, to code, and then testing that code, and then integrating that code and doing system testing, all the various steps one goes through in the application delivery lifecycle, making that more effective and you know, improving on the quality of what one is delivering and lowering cost and improving time to value. So those set of guidance and approaches is what is known as collectively known as DevOps. So it's, you know, unlike Agile, which became a formal methodology, or set of methodologies like Scrum or SAFe, DevOps is not a methodology. It is more of a cultural movement to get the various stakeholders in the application delivery pipeline working together in a lean and effective manner. A lot of lean principles are used in DevOps, which are also there in Agile. So they're obviously interconnected.
Yeah.
Now, enter data ops, right? The data ops term has evolved a lot, and I think it's still evolving. In fact, if you search Google data ops, you'll see many, many, many versions of it. And people often, you know, because it sounds like DevOps, relate it to DevOps. The theme is very similar, right? In the sense that, like in application delivery, I have multiple stakeholders. I have analysts, I have architects, I have developers, I have testers, I have operations practitioners. They all need to work collectively to make my application development and delivery processes effective. The same way in the data space, I have data owners, the business which people who own the data which is being generated as the business interacts with customers and does transactions, or as your system runs and you're getting logging and monitoring and telemetry data. Then you have the data managers. These are the DBAs and the data scientists who manage all the data, and the engineers who take care of making sure the data is available and the data is secure and is backed up and recoverable and all that. And then there are the data consumers. These are the data scientists, the application development professionals, and eventually the end users who are consuming the data directly or consuming the insights which are coming out of that data. All of these people need to work collaboratively and effectively to deliver that data to the end user, to your customer. That's kind of the theme of DataOps, is how do I make that happen? What kind of technology do I need? What kind of process improvement do I need? And most importantly, what kind of culture do I need in my company to make that happen? Now, there are a lot of similarities. The wording seems and the theme seems very similar to DevOps, but data is very different from code.
Yeah.
Right? Code is something we handcraft, right? As a developer, I consider writing code art, right?
Yes.
Whereas data is something that's got generated, right? And it's always growing and you can't control it and you can't throw it away either, right? I mean, you can throw away code, which is bad, but you cannot throw away data. So a lot of similarities, a lot of differences.
For any folks who are joining us kind of from startup land, you might have grown up with DevOps almost in your professional life. And so you might not understand what it was when it became a thing. But in the olden days, like, you know, there used to be software developers and then like the IT folks who would then deploy your thing for you. And there used to be this big problem of like software developers would build a thing and then like IT would have to deploy it and like it would break in a bunch of places and everyone would get mad at each other. DevOps was a way of essentially like bringing an engineering mindset into the whole deployment pipeline. And so I think it's really interesting, Sanjeev, that you're talking about doing something similar with data and actually like taking people from this this mindset of like being divided between, oh, like I'm you know, just the guy who's working on the data, like I don't care where it comes from, or like I just want a nice clean data set, to know like this entire process is a pipeline that has to be kind of optimized like from start to finish and actually get people to all work together. So I'm wondering, like, how do you accomplish that in practice? How do you get an organization to structure itself so that it operates this way?
That's a great question, Edward, because, you know, if you look back at the lessons we learned, you know, helping organizations adopt DevOps, though especially the non-startups, the legacy companies, the enterprise companies, the biggest challenge was always on the organizational change side, the culture side. You know, just like the startups.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, you could take a co-located two pizza team, the proverbial two pizza team, in a large enterprise, and you could do DevOps without any challenges, right? Because everybody was on the same team. You had a cross-functional team. You got, you know, what a lot of people refer to as a full stack team to work together mm-hmm. and deliver something. But once you started scaling and started getting large programs involved, large, people involved, and, you know, you're suddenly not trying to get DevOps scaled to 20,000 app dev professionals. And there are silos which go through several layers of management before a common stakeholder appears, and maybe at the C-suite level between dev and ops or between dev and ops and DBAs. That's where the challenge became is how do I get them to work together, right? And how do I get them to collaborate? How do I get them to understand what their challenges were, right? The developers would, you know, want something from the DBAs, and the DBAs would say, if you just want me to, you know, create a copy of the database for testing purposes, well, that's very low on my priority list because yeah. I've got to go do this, you know, rollback of this large database, or I've got to go fine tune because I'm having performance issues in this production database. That's a priority today. And your request is to get the priority understood by the various stakeholders so that they realize that everybody is responsible for delivering value to the customer. And that from an app dev side requires code flowing continuously, updates of code flowing continuously to production. And the DBA was a stakeholder in that. And that, I'm just giving you a DBA example, right? It could be a mm-hmm. security professional, it could be a QA professional, it could be an analyst, it could be, you know, the CFO who's not releasing funds because it's, hey, it's Q4, I can't release funds till January 1st. Well, I need to release software, I can't wait. So all that needs to now be done on the data side. And there are huge differences, right? There is not a data pipeline is not analogous,
mm-hmm. yeah.
similar to application delivery pipeline, right? The stakeholders are different. Their responsibilities are different, right? And data, especially when it's data sets and which we need to truly do real data science, to do real machine learning, are not easy to manage. They're not easy to say, okay, I'll just create, you know, it's not, I can't say, you know, I'll just fork the Git repository and get another code base for me to work on without trampling, you know, on this other team's work. Well, I can't do that with a 2 petabyte data set mm-hmm. or even a 2 terabyte data set very easily. So those are the challenges from a technology perspective and a process perspective which needs to be addressed. And, you know, we at Delphix are working on are addressing some of those. But from a cultural perspective, where I'll give you an example where a customer I was talking to, they said they do not have any data set available which is not archived for a period beyond 5 years, right? If I'm going to say, okay, how does my system behave every Thanksgiving or every tax day, right? Which is, you know, in April for here in the United States. Well, if I can only get data sets for the last 5 years, I can only get 5 data points. And that's not sufficient to really train a model. Maybe I want, if the company's been around for 40 years, why can't I get 20 years worth of data? Well, it's a cultural thing. All that data is archived. They just don't give access to anybody to it, and they don't have a way to extract that data beyond, you know, for reporting purposes or compliance reasons. So that's a cultural change. That's a cultural shift which the company needs to make to start treating their data as a live asset, which can bring business value, as opposed to this is something I store, and my job is to keep under lock and key so hackers don't get to it. And beyond that,
yeah, I think it's another one of those constant reminders that enterprise scale companies and startups and scale ups are genuinely different animals. The fact that you can't separate that cultural and the technological problems and just all the different strategies you do have to evolve to succeed in those environments. This kind of makes me think a little bit, so we spend a lot of our time talking to people trying to break into data science, and a big subsection of the folks we talk to, maybe not the majority, but a good chunk, are looking to break into some enterprise-scale companies. And one of the challenges that they often see is the technological barrier to entry. Maybe they should look at the culture more as well. But technologically, enterprise-scale companies use a lot more proprietary software. You know, they might use, you know, SAS instead of Python, for example. So if you are looking to break into that kind of environment and, you know, you don't want to buy an expensive license for proprietary software, what suggestions would you have for people who are trying to bridge that technological gap, learn some of those skills with a view to getting hired in an enterprise scale company as a data scientist?
Well, first of all, you got to realize is, you know, in an enterprise, you'll find all kinds of technologies. There are very few large enterprises who have standardized so well, even on a database, that they'll say, okay, we only have, you know, Oracle, or we only have a particular database. They'll have a lot of everything, right?
Yeah.
Across the enterprise. So the recommendation I would give to somebody who's trying to break into an enterprise from a data science perspective is that know the basics, right? Focus on the basics. Don't get distracted by the technological differences, right? If you are a good data scientist and you understand your craft, which is building models, training models, and, you know, helping the inferences, don't get discouraged or distracted by, you know, or they're a SAS, you know, company, or they are using this particular proprietary stack, or maybe they're using everything is on there. I've only worked with data sitting in the cloud in one of these modern NoSQL databases, and everything there is SQL. If you know the basics, if you know the core technology, if you know, you know, you're part of the craft, right? Remember, you will never be alone in a large company. You will be on a team which will have people who have the technical expertise, right? Which is very different from a startup where you're in a small team and you are expected to do everything related to your job, right? The proverbial full stack engineer, right?
Yeah.
So you are expected to, if you're a data scientist for a startup, you'll be expected to do the data engineering, the data wrangling. You'll be expected to do, you know, build your model. You'll be expected to learn the application deployment technology which is being used, and you built your, you know, strength around that. When you go to an enterprise, that's not the way it is, right? You'll be a part of a larger team, which will have multiple stakeholders who will have functional responsibilities, and they'll bring the technical expertise where you might not have it. Mm-hmm. So focus on your craft, which is, I know how to take data irrespective of where it's stored and extract inferences around from it using, you know, all the algorithms and the models and the modeling techniques I know. And I know how to build a model, how to train a model and fine tune it and do feature engineering, whatever your core craft is. Focus on that, and then, you know, once you start working with the enterprise, you know, understand, you know, what do they need from you to fulfill, you know, the needs of their technology stack. So I think that will, you know, if you focus on, you know, first principles, right, on the core of what you, of your skill, of your craft, then the technological differences shouldn't bother you.
Right.
And otherwise, you know, hey, and my kind of role, right? Every tech company I walk into,
yeah,
there's like a different technology stack. Hey, as I said earlier, if I get on from the wrong floor, it's a totally different technology stack, right? One call I had today, we were working with data on a mainframe, right? The call I had yesterday, we were doing a comparison, you know, talking about the ability to do everything on RDS on Amazon, right? And, you know, I was doing a demo this morning of this new open source project we just launched. I was using MongoDB to do that demo. Mm-hmm. So as long as I know, am I an expert in any of these technologies? Absolutely not, right? But know the core, what I'm trying to achieve, picking up the nuances of that technology are sufficient. As long as I know, as long as I'm very self-conscious of the fact that I am not an expert, I need to ask for help where I am not an expert, right? Whereas I think in a startup, one is expected to become the expert,
yes,
right? And be the expert in the entire stack. That's not how enterprises work.
It's really interesting the overlap between, you know, the type of environment, the type of the scale of the company, and then the immediate implications that has for the technological realities on the ground. I think that's something that it's so easy to miss out on when you're focused on just the technology, on just, you know, mastering whatever it is, scikit-learn or pandas or SQL or what have you. In enterprise companies versus startups, the difference becomes really stark. One question I did want to ask, in part because you have had such a broad range of experience spanning a long time horizon, how has data science and data analytics and then data infrastructure evolved over the last decade or so? And then maybe as well, if you can speak to where that leads, like where you see these changes going in the future.
Well, the evolution has been fairly staggering, right? And the evolution, the speed of that evolution of whether it is the applicability of data science and all the AI and machine learning algorithms to the business world, that it has really accelerated, right? I mean, mm-hmm. as we were talking about earlier, right? Watson was what, 8-9 years ago when it, you know, we had the day when the humans were finally defeated by by the supreme robots, right?
For the first time.
For the first time. Well, you know, it had happened before in chess, but this was in truly what we thought was a human domain, mm-hmm. right? Where it wasn't just memorizing, but actually drawing conclusions and inferences. But if you look at the history of AI and machine learning, or if you look at how algorithms we use today to build our machine learning models, they are not new. Some of those algorithms have been around for decades, right? I mean, my first exposure to AI was when I was in grad school back in, okay, let's just say many, many Linux versions ago, right? Yeah. So, and we were learning about, you know, neural networks and genetic programming back then, and none of the core technology, of course, it's evolved, but it has not evolved drastically, the core algorithms. What has evolved is our ability to put the compute power behind it to be, and the storage capability to actually draw inferences from the data, to actually apply those models and be able to use enough compute power mm-hmm. that we can get inferences in fairly short periods of time. Right. Yeah. I mean, just think, I was watching somebody do the summon, smart summon on their Tesla.
Yeah.
Just 2 days ago. Right. And the Tesla drove itself out of the garage, avoided hitting my car, which was parked on the driveway, and made its way all the way out to where we were standing. And I'm thinking, this is a mobile car. You know, it mm-hmm. has enough compute power to analyze all this data.
Yeah.
And we were walking around, right? We were purposely walking around to see, you know, would it detect us? And would it, you know, and we were afraid that, you know, okay, hopefully it'll stop in time. But we were trying to trick it, and we couldn't, right? I mean, just think of the compute power available in a car, and it's doing it in real time. It's not going to go over the cloud and compute else down. There's not just enough time for that. There's too much lag latency there. It's doing it in the car.
Yeah.
And now if you take that, I have all the compute power of my data center or a cloud, and I'm able to use GPUs and TPUs to really accelerate. And then I have the storage capability of an S3 or its equivalent, whatever other clouds have to do, store those large data sets and manage these large data sets and even version them. What can I achieve today? And that's mm-hmm. where I think the investment has gone, that we can today actually apply those algorithms and those models to real world business problems and get inferences and be able to react in short enough a period of time that they're worth reacting to, right?
Yeah.
What good is me getting results 2 days later and, you know, I can't get on a campaign now? It, based on the personalization, it has to give me the recommendations now. It can't email them to me 2 days later.
Yeah.
It's too late, right? So that's what's changed, and that's where I believe has been the most advancement over the last decade.
Yes, and that has a real effect on the speed of development of these algorithms too. Because
sure.
if I'm a developer, like I can test, you know, 10 things in a day instead of testing 10 things in a month, and that means the pace of the architecture is getting better, accelerates even more.
Absolutely, right? I mean, the whole point of test, and you know, there's a lot of experimentation and trial and error involved in fine-tuning all the parameters in my model.
Yeah.
And if every run of that A-B test takes 2 days, I'm not going to be doing too much A-B testing, too much fine-tuning. But if I can get the results that I can run dozens of these tests and try various tuning settings of my parameters and be able to get the results in a fairly short period of time, I will have a much better fine-tuned model at the end. And I will have a better understanding of what each parameter's, you know, variability, how it impacts the results of how my algorithm behaves. And that was just not possible, you know, 10 years ago.
This is really interestingly reflected in some of the other conversations we've had on the podcast, where we often ask, you know, what direction is data science going in, and what are data scientists going to be doing with their time, you know, 5-10 years from now? This is, I think, as close to hitting the nail on the head as we've ever done here in terms of explicitly saying, like, the thing that's driving data science in the direction more so of engineering is the availability of these compute resources. So when you have compute resources that are this powerful, now the real question is, okay, who is best at manipulating and wielding those resources, rather than necessarily who knows their model, you know, the best, or who knows their data the best. Not that those two things aren't important, but the engineering side almost allows you, like, you can lean on engineering as a crutch when you have enough compute.
Absolutely, right? And, you know, it that will become the, you know, again, like it, anything as it advances, technology advances, right? I mean, what was a skill a few years ago mm-hmm. is a commodity today, mm-hmm. right? So compute is becoming a commodity today. Storage is becoming a commodity today. Memory and network are becoming mm-hmm. a commodity today, right? And now with the evolution of things like TPUs, right, we will see basic algorithms being commoditized, right? So it won't be a question of how well do you know, your algorithm. It'll become how well can you understand the data and the fabric of that. Fabric of data is a wrong phrase, because data fabric means totally something else. The texture of that data, mm-hmm. right, is a better way of explaining it. And how well do you understand the business requirements? What is the business really looking for in terms of inferences and results in order to fine-tune the model for the texture of the data you have access to, right? You know, data has variances, data has noise, and that noise will not go away. And I'm not talking about bad quality noise, I'm talking about good noise, mm-hmm. right? There is good noise, there is a signal and a noise, right? And there is good noise, and then there is bad quality data where, you know, the fields are wrong. And, you know, recently there was an example, I think, in the UK of an insurance being sold to somebody called Mickey Mouse, which was actually a test, user they were using, but they actually issued an insurance policy to Mickey. You know, that's a data cleansing issue. Right? Yeah. There's a data sanitization issue. But, you know, there is noise. There are outliers. There's somebody in trading who will go and place an outlier trade, right? Is that mm-hmm. is that now bad quality? No, it's an outlier. But you, unless you recognize it's an outlier move, which happens, you know, it is truly an outlier and you need to ignore it. And not just, you know, let your model get totally skewed because you included it in your data set. That intelligence, that ability to understand what is an outlier, what is not, what impact will I have to, if I include the outlier whether versus excluding it, that understanding of the data's texture and variance of the signal and the noise, I think that's where that's what will differentiate a good data scientist over somebody who just knows the basics.
Yeah, I guess in the limit, as long as we don't have AGI, there's always going to be value in that skill of being able to bridge the gap between the business and product and then the technology side. And actually, maybe related to that, what would be your then recommendation to, let's say, a data scientist today who's trying to build a competitive advantage, try to, say, build a skill that's going to be robust against automation or, you know, the development of further compute? Do you have any suggestions there?
Yeah, and, I would say learn the domain. Right, understand your domain, understand the domain in which you are applying it, right? Because if you can marry your core data science skills with the domain in which you're operating it, whether it's financial services, even within financial services, there are several subdomains like, you know, banking, investment banking, insurance, or whether it's healthcare, whether you're on the, you know, payer side or the delivery side, all these subdomains, they all have nuances. They all have, different business needs. And understanding that domain will allow you to better apply your data science skills over you know, an expert at just the data science piece, but doesn't understand the domain, because that person will not be able to understand what the business is really looking for.
That's just fantastic advice and probably a great note to end on as well. Thanks so much for the great conversation, Sanjeev. I do want to ask, I know you've written a book actually. Do you mind giving that book a quick plug? And then do you have any other links as well you want to?
Well, unfortunately, my book is not on data ops and data science. It was written before I started working in that space. It is on DevOps. It's called the DevOps Adoption Playbook. And it's available at most major booksellers. I have recently started blogging about data ops and data science and the role of data in both application delivery and in data science. And that can be found on my blog, which is sdarchitect.blog, like software delivery architect. You can find my blog post there. And we at Delphix also just launched an open source project called Titan Data, which is to allow users to version data sets locally on their laptop or desktop and using Git commands. So it's titan-data.io. It's fully open source. I would encourage our people who are interested in, you know, playing around with data and understanding some of the data wrangling techniques, or if they're doing application development and need to manage data sets locally, to check it out. It's titan-data.io. Get involved in the community. And, you know, as I said, it's an open source project, which we just, you know, launched a few weeks ago.
Awesome. Two cheers for open source. That's fantastic. We'll be sure to include links to all those things as well in the description of the blog post that will accompany this podcast as well. Thanks so much for hopping on. It was a real pleasure.